the way your brain works changes as you go from one state to another, right? From being totally zoned out, right? You know, the undergraduate in the back of the large lecture hall, maybe doing the head bob thing, yeah. right? Between like that state versus being really super focused and yeah. and like paying close attention to something that's really important, right? You can feel that your brain is operating differently in different states. So we spent a long time looking at that. And then we thought, you know, we're missing half the signals or more in the brain.
The human brain is the most complex structure in the known universe, and we are in the middle of a scientific revolution to understand its inner workings. Join us for a conversation with world-renowned neuroscientists as they visit Rochester. I am Dr. John Fox, director of the Del Monte Institute for Neuroscience at the University of Rochester, and you are listening to Neuroscience Perspectives.
Hi, I'm John Fox, director of the Del Monte Institute for Neuroscience at the University of Rochester. And I'd like to welcome you to another episode of Neuroscience Perspectives. Today, I have a fantastic guest with us, Dr. Jessica Carden, who is an associate professor of neuroscience at Yale University School of Medicine. Jess, welcome to Neuroscience Perspectives.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, we really appreciate you being here. So you really, you sort of pioneer of studying circuit dynamics and kind of a scavenger of techniques to get at that, which is fantastic.
I really like that. Yes.
Just, you know, if there's a technique out there that can help you get after something, that's, you know, I'm sort of just looking at the work that you've been doing. It's like you're going to get it and make it work for you. And I think that's really admirable. What gets you up in the morning? What are you excited about at the moment?
Oh my gosh, we have diversified so much in the last few years. The real truth is that I get bored after 4 or 5 years of doing any one thing. So every few years, I think it's partly that I get a little restless and we do something new, or someone new comes to the lab and has a different set of ideas, and then we go off in a completely different direction than I was anticipating. So sometimes that takes us in directions that I would not have predicted. But right now, you know, we had this long series of experiments where we were really trying to deeply understand, how the way your brain works changes as you go from one state to another, right? From being totally zoned out, right? You know, the undergraduate in the back of the large lecture hall, maybe doing the head bob thing, yeah. right? Between like that state versus being really super focused and yeah. and like paying close attention to something that's really important, right? You can feel that your brain is operating differently in different states. So we spent a long time looking at that. And then we thought, you know, we're missing half the signals or more in the brain. Like, we're only looking at neurons, mm-hmm. the firing of neurons. We're not looking at any of the other relevant signals. And so
tell our audience what those other signals are then.
Right. So, you know, so there are all of these neurotransmitters floating around, right? Sometimes, you know, in the shorthand for this is neuroscientists, is sometimes that your brain is sort of swimming in a soup of neurotransmitters and other chemicals that are, you know, floating around and right. being released all the time. And some of them are pretty familiar, I think, to most people, things like acetylcholine or especially norepinephrine, right? Those are things that you hear about often. And they're frequently targets of therapeutic drugs for psychiatric conditions, you know, because right. we know that when they're released, they modify brain activity,
right?
And we know that they're associated with things like changes in your mood or changes in your attention levels, right? And so we thought, we are missing all of these signals. And so now we've developed a whole series of approaches in the lab where we can look at the neurons, right, the brain cells, and we also can see all those other signals at the same time.
Right.
And then in parallel to that, we also started thinking about, well, wait, there are other cell types. Like, we're only looking at one cell type. You know, maybe we should be looking at these other cell types that are in the brain that do all these other functions, you know, that may be related to some of these changes in brain function over time. And so that took us to looking at non-neuronal cells, right? So we just now, for the first time, have projects starting up looking at non-neuronal cells, which is super exciting, right? Yeah. Because, you know, it's a whole side of the brain that, you know, I've never really thought about.
And all to the end of sort of decision-making processes or motivated behavior.
It's
an interesting thing, you know, getting all of these signals. So maybe a philosophical question, and you know, I think a lot of people in the sciences quite would laugh at this, like, you know, if we could measure every single neuron in the brain and every neurotransmitter system and arousal system and all the rest of it, and we were able to gather all that information, would we get to new understanding? Or would we have recreated the monster, right?
Yeah, I mean, do you need something even more complex than the brain in order to be able to understand the full workings of the brain, right? This is the thing that keeps teenagers up at night, like staring at the ceiling and stuff. Like, how does my brain work? We have sort of parallel problems, right? And this was the start of the Brain Initiative, actually, with the NIH, right? This is the Brain Initiative, which has funded an enormous amount of spectacular technology development and new ways of accessing brain circuits, right? Started because of this idea that if you could just measure everything, you could measure all the neurons, right? You would really understand the system. And that has given rise, I think, to this enormous upswing in big data in neuroscience, right? Get in there and record everything, right? Yeah. And then so we have this one problem, which is like, how do you do that? Right, so we need new technical approaches, and that's been really productive. Right, we have all kinds of new approaches for this. You know, you can record all kinds of things, but you have a parallel problem, which is what do we do with this enormous pile of data? Right,
right, like, and how do you turn it into human understanding?
Yeah, biological interpretability. Right, yeah, like how do we distill this into something that I can actually tell you that gives you intuition about how the brain works?
Right, exactly. Right? Yeah.
And that's a much bigger problem, as it turns out. And, you know, people are solving that in different ways. And I think, you know, we've spent some time in our own group and in collaboration with Mike Higley's lab, with whom we share a lot of projects and equipment and stuff, developing new analytical techniques, new math, basically, right, like playing around with some math. But also now we've kind of branched out into machine learning approaches and other model-based approaches that can help us take this incredibly complex series of signals and try to distill it down into what are the important bits.
That, you know, this, I'm really interested in this idea of taking what is very, very complex material data, doing some dimensionality reduction on it to turn it into something that a human being can actually wrap their mind around. But then the next step, of course, is one thing to have your training and to be able to understand these concepts because of your training, right? But then to communicate that to the public who pay the bills.
Yeah, absolutely.
Does that keep you up at night too, or do you worry about that?
I think I ask it
in the context of a time, like a time, geopolitical time, where the public trust in science, which used to be extraordinary, you know, 95% of people in the early noughties, you know, just thought, you know, had profound trust in science. And, you know, we come through a pandemic and we've lost our audience a little bit. Now, you know, people have sown a lot of doubt and so on.
Yeah. I guess my perception of some of what's gone wrong, I think, is in how we all think and communicate about what the scale of the problem and the unknowns is. Right. You know, we've been, you know, as a field, right, neuroscience, in the sense of putting electrodes in someone's brain, has existed since maybe the 1920s, let's say,
right
where the first recordings were made of patients, right, mm-hmm. you know, showing changes in brain activity with changes in cognitive function, right? So you ask patients to do a task, a math problem, right, and see a change in brain activity, right? That's dates to the 1920s. So basically, it's been about 100 years, right? And you would think that in 100 years, we might have solved everything. But the truth is that it's so complex, right? I mean, it is fascinating and complex, and it's an enormous problem, right? Like, we don't have all the answers, right? And I think it's a mistake to suggest that we are so competent, so good. We're just so smart that we're going to solve the brain now, mm-hmm. right? We're probably going to be working on this for hundreds of years, right? You know, I would give it another century, right? You know, it's an enormous challenge, right?
Yeah.
So I think some of it's our fault for not communicating what the hell we're doing,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and then some of it is also this idea that, you know, we should be only focusing on disease, Right, because in my mind, I think the basic research, the how does the thing work, should go hand in hand with how do I fix it when it's broken.
Well, you just anticipated two of my questions. One was, because I wanted to pivot to that, because I think that's a super important point, which is, you know, just studying something for the sake of the knowledge of how it works and not having to have the filter of utility in a disease or something down the road. But you do think about disease in your work.
We do, yeah. We used to work primarily on neurodevelopmental disorders, mm-hmm. right? So autism, schizophrenia. And in my lab, because most of what we do is fairly reductionist, right? We are getting in there in the circuits and manipulating things. It's mostly animal models of genetic diseases, right? So specific genetic mutations that are known to be associated with a disease. And you know, our goal is really to try to understand what are the consequences of that genetic mutation, right? And not necessarily at the level of expression of a gene, but rather it's more holistic consequences for how does that change the way the brain works.
Right.
And then in recent years, we sort of kind of fell a little bit into the other end of things, if you will. So aging and neurodegeneration. And you know, there we were looking at several models of Alzheimer's disease. In part because the same sort of thing I said earlier, you know, we kind of fell into a couple of interesting ideas and then realized that there were interesting questions that we hadn't answered yet. And, you know, started doing these longitudinal studies where we're imaging individual animals as they age, you know, which is really fascinating and generates an enormous amount of data, which we're still grappling with, right? But, you know, there are multiple ways to look at the disease models, right? One of them is that they're a tool. Right. So it is a targeted way of breaking the system. Right. And then by perturbing it, you understand a little bit better how it worked when it was working.
Right.
The other way to look at the disease model work is that these are all very complicated disorders. Right. And they don't have autism is a great example. They're like 1,000 autism related genes. Right. Yeah. And they do wildly different cell biological things.
Right.
And we, at a fundamental level, do not understand how genetic perturbation of genes that do completely different things at the level of a single cell could give rise to something that we perceive as being a common endpoint.
Right.
We perceive all of those consequences as having something in common. It's all under the umbrella of autism spectrum disorder.
Right.
That lack of understanding really highlights our lack of knowledge about the basics of how the brain works in the first place.
And this kind of idea, too, with diseases, like you mentioned, autism and schizophrenia, where quite a lot of those genes, the two diseases have in common, all of them.
Yeah, absolutely.
And yet, you know, perturbations in the genetics will send one person on a trajectory that ends up with an autism phenotype, which is really very distinct from a schizophrenia phenotype.
Yeah.
We have a lot to learn.
Yeah, there's just an enormous amount of unknown there, right? Yeah. And that's kind of why I feel like we do a bad job of communicating the scale of the challenge. It's
You said there as well. I we'll probably be doing it for another 100 years. I don't doubt that that's true. And a question that was in my mind is like, you know, you're in the lab, like myself, you know, and you're thinking about next year and the year after and that. But if you were to project out 10 years, like where do you see us in 10 years? Or is it an impossible question?
It is. So my part of the field, my little chunk of the field, right, is racing towards a much more model-based, high-throughput, high-dimensional data set kind of approach, right? So we are kind of converging on multimodal data with lots of different signals and needing those more model-based approaches to help us make sense of things. But so we're sort of, I think a lot of the field is moving towards a more holistic view of how things are working, how many different signals or parts of the brain are interacting at the same time.
And you mentioned machine learning has a big component
like
of this.
Machine learning are
you
nice
start
tools.
To take these extraordinary quantities of data that are from different systems, you know, on different timescales and try to put them into one matrix and get some derive some understanding. And this is the part where it's difficult for a human brain to grapple with all that. So,
I see a lot of that coming. You know, I think there's going to be more and more of that, which is, you know, great because it gives us that more holistic understanding, comes with some caveats, like you still need to go back again and get that biological interpretability, you know, at the other side. So
a big role for the AI revolution that we're really in the middle of, do you think, in helping to understand this? Or
it's a great set of tools in combination with all the other tools.
Right, I hear some skepticism.
I am a biologist at heart. In fact, I'm actually a sort of old school, crusty old electrophysiologist at heart. So really, truly, I want to see ground truth data, at the end of the day. So for me, it has to come full circle, right? I love all these tools, but at the end of the day, I want to be able to say, I gained a mechanistic level of insight into how, the circuits in the brain are working.
Yeah. So tell me, when did you catch the science bug? Like, was that baked in early?
It actually was. I was very fortunate to have, parents who love to, follow their kids' passions, and explore things and are really supportive. And so I got interested in looking at things in pond water, and my parents, took us out to the local pond, and we had water samples and, put hay in some of them and not in others, and looked to see what creatures developed, and had a little microscope. And
you're an experimentalist from the early age.
But with a lot of encouragement, to keep exploring,
And that was your parents were a major influence. Where did you grow up?
A little bit of everywhere, actually. Originally from Poughkeepsie, New York. So fond of upstate. We moved every few years for a while because my dad worked for IBM, actually.
Okay.
And so I've lived in Poughkeepsie, and I've lived in Dallas in the late 80s, which was fabulous. And then in Boulder, Colorado.
Very good. Dallas in the late 80s, was the TV show still running with JR?
Yeah, and no lie, it was all big hair and pickup trucks. So it was an interesting transition.
Fantastic.
But sort of fortuitous for me as well, because I landed in the end in a school there that had a very strong science program and encouraged all the kids to do science projects for the local science fairs, right? And so because it was an expectation, right? Like everybody did this, we got into doing science fair projects and so I think it sort of carried that thread through a little bit,
Tell me about mentorship then, like along the road, right? You pick up people, and there are people who have a major impact on the trajectory. Is there one or two people that you'd point to specifically and times in your life where this really made a big impact on you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of it came from, sort of early mentorship, in college, not even in a continuous sense, but in like key moments where, people take you into their lab and give you a spot in the lab and a project to work on,
right,
and then encourage you to keep going. And for me, grad school was amazing, because you end up with not just one mentor, but a whole team of people in the end that you interact with. And they may not all agree with each other in the end or have different mentoring strategies, but you can kind of pick and choose a little bit, the things that work for you.
Right. And through those experiences, have you picked up a specific mentoring style yourself? Is there something that you bring or that you'd say, this is a key component?
I think, thus far in my experience, so I've been at Yale for 14 years or so. Every student is different, mm-hmm. right? And I think if I have a mentoring style, it might be mostly centered around being very patient, trying to be very, very tolerant of the differences between other people, how their styles might interact with others in the lab group or with me. I try not to impose too many of my own, the expectations I had for myself, I try not to impose them on my students, they're so.
Yeah. I love that answer. I often get asked the same thing, and I say, people in a lab are just human beings, like the human beings in your world, in your life, and they come in all shapes and sizes, and you have to figure out a way to fit around that.
Yeah, everybody has a real life too, I mean, it isn't science 100% of the time, although sometimes it is. Like I have trouble turning off the science in my head. But you know, people come to the lab and they have had a bad day, or they have, you know, a family crisis, or, you know, or something else is more important that day than, you know, this one experiment. And, you know, that's a real thing. It's not just science. It's also everybody's real life too, you right. know.
Yeah. Now, we can't close this interview. We have a few more minutes, I think, without talking about your laundry room and the three blind mice or the nine mice. You have to tell that story. What went on there, and how did that happen, and how did your mother tolerate this?
It was partly their idea, my parents, right now. This is, again, back to high school science fairs, yeah. you know, and I had... We actually done some science fairs using pet guinea pigs in the years prior to this. So I had guinea pigs, and we had done learning and memory experiments, you know, with like, can they learn to associate a cue with a food reward and that kind of thing. Nice. And so we...
Okay. What age are you now with this?
So this would have been like 8th and 9th grade. So preteen, you know,
preteen,
like,
yeah.
you know, somewhere right. 12, so talking, 12 to 13. Young yeah. yeah, young, you know. Yeah. And I had wanted, you know, to do another science fair project like this. And so my parents helped me find a researcher at a local university. This was Southern Methodist, you know, in Dallas. Yeah. And a very kind researcher who gave me a set of mice, lab mice to work with, which we would never do now,
no,
right? Like,
no.
you know, sending lab mice home to some kid's house. No, this was, so we took the mice home. I had a group of males and a group of females, and I was interested in sex differences in learning and memory. And so we had a group of males and a group of females. We kept them in the laundry room for a while, and I would run them on this T-maze-based task where there was a cue. I also learned a bit about programming, because this is we had to collect all the behavioral data and then do statistics on it and everything. Fair. So, and then even in Texas, it gets cold at night sometimes, and the laundry room got very cold one night, and we had a whole bunch of mice with hypothermia. And
oh,
so
no.
my mom would tell you that she spent hours resuscitating hypothermic mice.
So was the hairdryer involved, or
I think just towels,
just towels,
rubbing,
okay.
you know? And you know, but in the end, it was actually a really cool data set. You know,
yeah.
we did great statistics, and I learned all about chi-square tests, and like, you know, and we had this sort of longitudinal learning data for males and females. It turns out the males were better better at learning the task. And, you know, and it was, you know, you could look at that and say that has all the parts of the same thing that I do with my grad students now, right?
Let me ask you one last thing before we stop. You know, a lot of people who tune into Neuroscience Perspectives are youngsters and young grad students, or you know, college students thinking about getting into a career in science. Do you have some gems, some pearls of wisdom, some guidance?
I love my job. This is so much fun, right?
Yeah.
It's a profession or a career for people who love to play, right? Love to think about ideas and be creative and play with the science. It has room for people who come from different backgrounds mm-hmm. with different perspectives. There's plenty of room for that in science these days, which is wonderful.
That's
right?
Yeah.
And, you know, and there are kind of endless opportunities right now, right? I mean, there are an enormous number of opportunities to do basic science, translational science, right? All the different flavors, right? And, you know, there are certainly these days more fellowships and summer opportunities and internships and
right.
postdoc spots and everything than there were 20 or 30 years ago, right? So I think I would view it as an opportunity,
yeah.
you know, if I were a student right now.
Well, that's it's fantastic. It's completely clear from the time we got spent together that you love your job, and I think that's a great message
yeah.
to go out on. Jess, thanks so much for being here in Rochester.
Thanks, it was really a pleasure.
Great to see you.
Cheers.